You are listening to From the Margins on CHSR 97.9.
Infinity.
Aggressive state intervention into the local labor movement that ensures that the radical labor movements are marginal.
What they're looking for now is less to get elected and more to come to the favorable attention of capital.
For the first time in history, we have a movement in this country led by indigenous peoples and most importantly, indigenous women.
Repeatedly, we've seen the attempt to criminalize black victims, to do anything to smear their names, to basically imply that black life isn't worth anything.
Our society teaches women to be ashamed of their bodies, to hate their bodies, to change their bodies.
We see increasing organized repression.
I'm stubborn. I'm not going to back down. This could go on for years and years and years.
People need to realize what type of struggle that they're on.
The police, of course, want you to believe that there's some kind of criminal reason behind this.
Take every day as an act of resistance, whether it was a strike, a riot, or whatever.
It's very difficult for people to engage in sustained dissent. I don't believe it's impossible, though.
Hello, good afternoon. This is From the Margins and got Acid for Sheed and Cody Jack here. Hello, Cody.
Hello.
All right, so today on the show, the broader subject is organizing the most precarious workers in society, Justice for Migrant Workers. A new campaign has been launched by Toronto and Vancouver-based organization Justice for Migrant Workers called Harvesting Freedom, marking 50 years of migrant farm workers in Canada and calling for major changes and long overdue justice. But in order to get ready for this call, we're going to go to a song. Cody, what do we got coming?
We're going to be playing some Shad Fam Jam.
Most of the nephews.
This is focusing on
especially the one in Toronto.
Yeah, this is the one.
My bad. For some immigrants. Yeah. From donated clothes to caps and gowns. It's a little shout to my black and brown folks that know the game, not in class to clown. Had the funny accent, look who's laughing now. See, Samir came here to grind, and he slaved at every minimum wage job. But he saved that, brought his sister on scholarship to make stacks. Working as a surgeon, she bought a whip and paid cash. No time to whine, we just face facts. Let's fit six in the back and let's take that to the best restaurants, make reservations. Since we out here, since they made reservations for First Nations and they never made reparations, the natives probably relate more to immigration. So this for y'all too, and I can't forget the Haitians here for an education. It's a celebration.
Not bad, huh? For some immigrants.
Draw lines and make borders real, but then bend the rules when there's more to drill. Don't turn away the stateless. Think of the waste if one in three refugees is a Lauryn Hill. Come a long way, we can move forward still. From the poorest to up by Lawrence, Forest Hill. But more than that, Skrillery Banks, just chill. Make a home, just build in a zone less ill. In a place to be safe, you found an escape route where we come from. So we grateful to Jesus. And now the top is the next stop. This drop ought to have my aunts on a guest spot, red hot. I'm talking going from sweatshops to tech stocks, doctors without borders with dreadlocks. We quote an S. Doc Carter on Otis, turns out some fresh off the boat kid wrote this. Not
bad, huh? For some immigrants.
Third world born, but first world born. Sometimes you feel pride, sometimes you feel torn. See, my mother tongue's not what they speak where my mother's from. She moved to London with her husband when their son was one. And one time after family ties, I turned on the news and saw my family die.
Why?
Pop said it's murder in the motherland and things about colonialism I didn't understand. All the things that shape a man and his mind state. A community income and crime rate. If times change, why my people still in dire straits? If it's a big world, show me where's my place in it. I had to talk to Pops for a minute. He said, Shad, this world wasn't home to begin with. Just keep defending the oppressed, take steps and keep rapping. You might just be the best. Well, yes.
Now,
just trying to get the call through to Chris and Ricky out in Toronto. So just take a second here. Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
All right. How you doing?
Chris, thanks for being on the show. Cody, do you want to get started?
Yeah, Chris, I was just wondering if you could explain to us a little bit more what the Justice for Migrant Workers organization is. Like, what is the history, the development of the movement, the, you know, the classic who, what, where, why, when kind of scenario?
Cool. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. I guess always thanks very much for all the time you guys have provided in showing solidarity with the migrant worker struggle. Today I'm joined by a brother of mine, Ricky, who will speak about his experiences in a few minutes. But prior to that, Justice for Migrant Workers, we are a collective of migrant workers, community allies, labor allies, of course, striving to change the temporary foreign worker programs here in Canada. We do so by trying to mobilize to fight for changes, to fight for progressive changes, and to learn from the history of struggle, where slavery and indentureship have created very much today's migrant worker programs are a legacy of both slavery and indentureship. So what we're doing is learning from the past forms of resistance, building and fighting against racial divisions, trying to create solidarity, and trying to fight where we have a fair food system.
Oh, thank you. And now specifically moving on to the Harvesting Freedom campaign, I understand this is part of the 50th anniversary of your organization as well. There was something to do with sending Justin Trudeau an RSVP. I'm wondering if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Great. So it's actually the 50th anniversary of the Seasoned Agricultural Worker Program. So just a bit of the history. So migrant workers have been coming to Canada through the Seasoned Agricultural Worker Program for 50 years. Migrant workers are the program. People are tied to an employer. They can work in Canada up to 8 months a year. They do not have any labor or social mobility. When workers face problems at work, such as injuries, sickness, they're basically sent home. Many workers are being sent home to die for conditions they're facing here. When they're injured, we download our health care responsibility onto their home countries. And most fundamental about this is that irrespective of how many years these workers have participated in this program, they do not have access to permanent residency. So in the 50th anniversary of the Seasoned Agricultural Worker Program, Justice for Migrant Workers has launched the Harvesting Freedom campaign. The demand of the campaign is to call for status upon arrival for all farm workers who come to the program, but also for migrant workers who participate in the temporary foreign worker program. So every month we'll be undertaking different actions to raise the issue of status, first of all. Second of all, later in the year, starting in September and ending in October, we're going to be launching a march and a pilgrimage and a caravan from the Windsor area, which for your listeners is just right across from Detroit, Michigan. And we're going to be walking all the way to Ottawa and hopefully the Parliament of Canada. And earlier this week, Ricky, myself, and several members of Justice for Migrant Workers went to Parliament Hill to have a press conference to launch this campaign. And second of all, we had a rally and a protest outside of Justin Trudeau's office, which is located right across from Parliament Hill. We attempted to give him a giant RSVP card, and at that point they didn't take it, so we're going to keep it, and we're going to keep using this information to build this campaign across Ontario, but across Canada.
Excellent.
Yeah, Chris, can you tell me specifically about the importance of trying to get migrant workers permanent residency? What would this change?
So this is a bit of a longer answer. I think I want for people to think about it this way. Imagine having a control put on themselves where they do not have the ability to exert their rights. So for us to start thinking about the fact that migrant workers not having the ability for permanent residency is a form of immigration control. It's a way of trying to keep workers complicit and docile and to exert fear so that they don't stand up for their rights. So we want to take away the power from employers to deny migrant workers rights. We want to ensure that migrant workers continue to build so they can exert their rights in the workplaces. And second of all, the reason why we're not calling for pathways to residency or saying that workers should be waiting in a long line is many of these workers, number one, have contributed decades to our agricultural economy. They basically live in Canada 8 months a year, many for 10, 15, 20. I've met sisters and brothers who've been here for up to 30 years. And so that's the first thing. It's about taking away the power of the employers. Number two, it's, you know, creating a compassionate humanitarian immigration system where the people who contribute to put food on our table have the ability to live with us and amongst us. So it's changing our immigration to meet the needs of our community and our society and not the economic interests of capitalists. Thirdly, historically, we've had this happen before. Right after the World War II period, Dutch farm workers were able to be provided status upon arrival. They came to Canada, they built their country across Southwest Ontario, the land that is, and they've contributed to society. So we're saying it's only fair that we have to look beyond skin color, we have to look beyond race to ensure that workers have the ability to live here as equal to us, and to understand that the racialized nature of the program denies them rights that others have received beforehand.
Speaking specifically in the area of rights, is there any level of protection for migrant workers coming to Canada, or is it pretty much you're left to your own devices if something bad happens, that falls on you kind of thing?
That's a really important question. So when you talk to the government officials and you talk to employers, their response is that migrant workers have every right that a Canadian has. However, these rights are basically guaranteed on paper, and they're only worth the paper they're written on. What we know is because people are tied to employer, because of the federal immigration restrictions, many workers are sent back home. So there is very little legal or written protection. The strength of the workers comes from when they get together and they stand up both in their workplaces and in their community for rights. So while the program is injustice, and they have many cards against them, workers do find ways to resist. So it's not because of the rights that are so-called given to them, nor is it because of what's written on paper, but it's because people are willing to take the sacrifices to make the changes for themselves, but also to improve conditions so their families can eat, just as they provide for food for our families.
Can you give us some examples of some concrete collective actions that have been used in the past by workers to get things improved in their situation?
Exactly. There's been several that I'll talk about very briefly. When workers, for instance, have workplace issues, workplace pesticides, chemicals, I know of a farm in the London area, London, Ontario, which is about 2 hours outside of Toronto, where workers were facing lots of dust, lots of chemicals, and they undertook a wildcat strike where they withheld their labor to get necessary equipment to protect themselves. There was a farm recently we heard about in Leamington, Ontario. What the workers complain a lot about, and my friend Ricky will tell you more about this, is something called the piece rate system. It's where the faster you work, mm-hmm. The more productivity goes to the employers. This has a negative impact on the bodies of workers. It's a serious health and safety concern. And what this does is have workers compete against each other. What we found in the Leamington area, while many farms do undertake the piece rate system, in one farm in particular, workers from Guatemala and Jamaica were able to come to an agreement and work together to slow down the process. For one, it doesn't hurt their bodies, and two, it's a way of also standing up against the supervisors and their authoritarian role. Thirdly, I'll mention is that in Simcoe, Ontario, when a farm was about to go under, when it was about to go bankrupt, it started to refuse to pay its workforce. But the workers, and these were workers from Barbados, from Jamaica, from Mexico and Trinidad, decided to withhold their labor. And they basically went on a strike as well, so that they said that if we're not going to get paid, we're not going to take care of your crops. And these are just three or four of the examples that I've talked to or we've experienced over the last couple of years. There are many, many others. A lot of times, because this is agricultural work, these struggles happen in silos or in isolation. So part of our work for Justice for Migrant Workers is, yes, we organize, but we also hear the stories from workers and we tell these stories. We ensure that other workers hear about what workers are doing, and we share these types of struggles, both the positive and the negative.
Okay, and you mentioned that Ricky is there. Is he available to speak right now?
Yes,
Oh, great. Hello, thank you for being on the show, Ricky.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity also. I'm down in the cold, so my voice is not that great, but I'm okay. I'll try my best.
Okay, thank you, thank you.
Hey, Ricky, this is Cody speaking. I'm one of the co-hosts with Asif. I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, like what industry you work in, where you're from, how you got to be where you are today, just anything that you can offer us, please.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm from the small island of the Caribbean named St. Lucia. I've been a migrant worker for the past 4 years. My experience is in the production of the greenhouse production of tomatoes and organic sweet peppers. My experience being a migrant farm worker, it meant, to me personally, it meant I had to share a bedroom with 8 colleagues. And that was tough for me. I've been on farms where there are more than 14 guys in a room. That is tough. On my farm, it meant I had to share 3 spoons of 14 burners with 62 colleagues. It meant to me that the bunkhouse, the house where we lived on the farm, there was no internet that we could communicate with our family. What is the point of earning money? What is the point of life that you cannot spend quality time with your family? What is the point? It meant to me, being a migrant worker, it meant working very, very long hours with no overtime pay. It meant working at a really fast pace for minimum wage.
You mentioned a lot about the conditions that you were experiencing at work. Now, at what point did you realize that you wanted to do something about it, that you wanted to try and change things?
Well, from day one on the farm, I noticed that the conditions are different to what I was expecting. Because prior to coming to work as a migrant worker, okay, let me give you the reason why I ended up working in Canada is because back home, the work I was doing, I was self-employed, and there was a major hurricane that destroyed my business. And directly after the hurricane, the country got infested with a disease, which really, really, the farmers find it really difficult to control. It's very expensive to control. And because of that, a lot of the farmers, they opted to go out of production. And because it's so expensive to control it. Another reason why I end up in Canada is because of the global financial crisis. In St. Lucia, the three pillars of the economy, the three things that really driving our economy back home was agriculture, tourism, and construction. Because of the global financial crisis, we have less people traveling, less people spending, so the country is not doing very well. Agriculture is not doing well because of the major disease now, and construction is very low. So because of these three main reasons, that's why I end up in Canada. But my specific situation is I have 2 kids. The mom passed away 11 years ago, and right now, like a couple of hours ago, I just got bad news that my daughter is skipping school, and my son is now using drugs. Now, it's partly because I spent so much time away from them. The mother being out of the equation, and I spent so much time away, so literally they're left to their own devices. And you know, that is the price I'm paying for being in Canada. Because what is the point in life of earning money and you cannot have a quality life or enjoy it with your family? You know, and so from day one, I wanted my kids to be here. And all my colleagues, all the migrant workers, they have problems with that.
What about bringing your kids to Canada? Is that even an option?
First of all, that is the point about our struggle. The system as it is right now, being a migrant worker, it has divided us into a group that so many rights have been denied. We are denied so many rights. One, for example, overtime. We do not get overtime. We only get the minimum wage. We are not allowed to bring our families home. You know, there's so many rights that we have been denied. So we are placing a really disadvantageous category that gives the employer all the rights, and we're basically in a group that is vulnerable, and we've been exploited and abused, especially in a country that which is a world leader when it comes to human rights. You know, Canada is known to be a safe place of refuge. Your human rights is guaranteed to each and every group. You know, I was really happy to come to Canada, but when I came to the farm, I really discovered the real dark side of Canada. That system as it is right now, it is really placing workers and the family in a disadvantage, and it is really continuing a and abuse.
Ricky, I was just wondering if you could explain how you found out about the program, the migrant worker program in Canada, how you were, yes, it was told to you, how it was described, and then how that differs from the actual reality of the program.
Okay. I got to know about the program from a few of my friends. The friends, I met them on Facebook or would communicate, and they told me that, well, when I told them of my situation, they told me, well, try to apply for, you know, the farm workers program. And as it is in my country, there's a government office that is set up for to play that role, where they would register you and get you the visa and do all the paperwork. Well, from day one, when I got to know that it's a government office, it set my expectation really high, that it is done at a governmental level, and the standards, you know, the standards would be really high. You know, whatever expectations I had, you know, I expected at the governmental level that it would be adhered to, you know, it would be delivered. But when I came to Canada, then it was a totally different thing. Every day, all the different activities that exist on the farm, it is very, very, very clear that it is exploitative. It is, you know, it gives the farm owner, the supervisors, a lot. They have lots of power. They will tell you that if you cannot perform, if you do not perform up to our expectation, that there's 100 people lined up, you know, waiting to take your position. Imagine there are farms in Canada where every day two workers at the bottom of the list, they're sent back to the bunkhouse. Why? As a form of punishment, to show them, to tell them, to penalize them for not meeting the standard that, you know, that they expect of them. I'm pretty sure that there are some activities that some workers are better at. Regardless of what activity they give you to do, they expect you to give over 200% every second, because you're always being threatened.
All the farm workers, migrant farm workers, are experiencing these really difficult conditions. Like, they have to work twice as fast as everyone else.
That's right.
Yeah, and I'm wondering about the process of how farm workers can relate to each other these struggles and get together, and how difficult is it to actually do anything to try and make things better?
From my experience, and on some of the farms that I was able to visit, there's a technique that the employers use, right? On my farm, there are people from four different countries. On my farm, there are people from Barbados, from St. Lucia, from Jamaica, Guatemala. And with the Guatemalans being Spanish-speaking, that makes the language a barrier. So communication wasn't easy. So it's difficult for us to communicate and to discuss issues. That's one. So communication alone is one technique that's used on the farm. And another technique is the fact that we're from different islands, from different countries, we compete with each other. We want the farmer to say that people from St. Lucia are way better than Jamaicans. They want the farmer to say that Jamaicans are way better than Guatemala. And so we have that kind of competition. Another technique that is used on the farm, I call it a variable piece rate system, because what I'm accustomed to back home, I'm accustomed to a piece rate system that is fixed. You're given a fixed amount to produce for the week. If you know that you meet it, you know where you stand. You know, if you go above and beyond, you know where you stand. But on the farm system, it's a variable piece rate system. Variable because every week it keeps on changing. Only the one or two guys at the top that would get to benefit from that. And what happened? It creates competition. And every day in the bunkhouse, you'd hear the divisiveness that is creating. There's lots of competition, and it creates more enemies rather than friendship. So all of these little techniques are making it difficult for us to unite and, you know, work for the betterment of the.
Ricky, have you found that in your experience trying to solve problems on the farm, has it been more effective to use collective action instead of attempting to, you know, appeal to the law or the legal side of things through the government?
Well, to be honest, it's difficult for us to mobilize on the farm from my experience. It's a little difficult because of some of the reasons I just outlined there. Language barrier is one. The competitiveness among the people from different countries, it makes it difficult to unite. And you see what happened. The solution, I think, as it is right now to the problems we have, it is more at a legislative level. And that is where I think, you know, our efforts should be get towards, you know, mobilizing for those legal changes that can bring the solution to the problem. Because the solution really lies in changing the law as it is right now. And really bringing it at the farm level, a lot of power is in the hands of the farmers. So to bring about those changes, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to bring it on the farm level, but rather on a legislative level.
So at this, you see this is kind of the important part of the Justice for Migrant Workers organization in terms of the communication and the education of the population?
Yes, because what happened, it is calling for, you know, partnership with all the sister unions to basically apply the pressure that's needed to basically achieve that the goal that we are seeking.
Are you pleased about all the media attention that the campaign has been getting? Harvesting Freedom has gotten a lot of media attention in the last week. Is this promising for you to see this?
Yes, certainly, because what happened, as I said, it called for legislative changes, and for that to happen, we need the support of the media and the general public. And the other thing too is that in Canada, the impression I'm getting, based on the meetings that we've been having, the average Canadian do not know of such conditions exist in Canada, and that is where the media is coming really, really useful and handy in educating the public as to, you know, that these conditions exist in a country that preaches, you know, inclusiveness and diversity, in a country that boasts of, you know, that's the image that Canada has, you know, that human rights is guaranteed to one and all, you know, and a country that's a leader, a world leader, you know. I mean, it's so surprising that Canadians do not know that such conditions exist, you know. Look at the Syrian refugee case. Isn't that giving the impression, the impression that Canada is a safe place of refuge? That is the impression I have of Canada. It's a safe place of refuge. And our struggle is over 50 years. Would it be unfair for us to ask for status on arrival that would guarantee better human conditions after 50 years of a program? A lot of people are not aware of these conditions existing in Canada, and the media is playing a really, really critical role in educating and also mobilizing the support that we need to bring those changes that, you know, that basically bring fairness to all the workers. That's all we want. Fairness to all the workers. And fairness to all the workers means guaranteeing status on arrival for some.
On that point, talking about fairness for all workers, how do you see this improvement of the conditions for migrant workers helping all Canadian workers? Do you see a connection?
Basically, what I know is that Canadian workers, as it is right now, they're entitled to so many things that we ourselves, we make contributions to, but we do not benefit from it. For example, one simple example is EI. We make the contributions into that, and we do not get the benefits out of that. In no way would it would be disadvantage to a Canadian. It's fairness across the playing field. That's all we're asking for. Fairness across the playing field. Fairness that the migrant worker too can work in a place with his family right next to him. Fairness that would mean that the worker is working in better conditions. I mean, what does that mean? Like, to me, it means productivity for Canada. That, to me, that's what it means.
Okay. If I could just add that this is about improving standards for all workers. And it's about taking away the power from employers, the provincial and the federal government to create conditions where migrant workers are blamed for driving down wages, for increasing conditions. By addressing the conditions of migrant workers, we're getting at the heart of precarious labor. We're addressing the precarious labor market that occurs globally. So one, I think, is about improving standards for all by focusing on the most vulnerable. And with the previous question, I think it's looking at a series of different tactics, both in the workplace, in the community, and at the provincial and federal governments, to try to create better conditions for migrant workers, but to also to address not only our labor policies, but also our trade policies.
Yeah, that's another thing I was wondering about with the agreements with the countries, those bilateral agreements. Canada has an agreement with all these countries in which migrant workers are coming from, and how within those agreements there's conditions that really are unfair for migrant workers, and how to affect those. Can you talk a bit about the bilateral agreements and about what are some efforts to try to make better conditions within those bilateral agreements?
To be honest, I cannot speak to that. I do not know the real content of those bilateral agreements. However, what I can speak to is when it comes to international trade and whatnot, globally, I know that countries and businesses, they ensure that the products and the goods that they order, they want it to come from farms and countries where labor is, does not work in slavery conditions, that the working conditions meet minimum standards and so on. And I'm pretty sure that some of these places that import goods and services from Canada, maybe they're not aware that these conditions exist on the farm, and I'm pretty sure that if they do become aware, or when they do become aware that these conditions exist, that they would pressure the government also to better the conditions for migrant workers.
Okay.
If I could just add that, I think what Ricky was mentioning earlier about the global economic crisis and how it impacted the banana industry in its home country, I think that's quite telling, what's happening in the global south, where the conditions being imposed by Europe, the United States, and Canada are destroying local economies and is forcing people into migration programs, first of all. Second of all, you know, I think there's a question that needs to be, and it's a fundamental question about our free trade agreements. Do we want to create societies where capital has more rights than communities? What we're seeing through the bilateral agreements, through free trade, through NAFTA, is a creating of conditions where workers' wages are being driven down to the lowest common denominator. We're based on economic units, not as people, which is the first problem. Ricky mentioned earlier what we should be going towards, and that's agreements where, you know, some people call it fair trade, but I would call it prioritizing the rights and the humanity of our peoples first and foremost. And we actually do have stuff like this. If you look at our pension agreements, where our pensions are portable, which means that they could be accessed anywhere across the world. Canada has signed many agreements like that. With employment insurance, currently migrant workers have problems accessing these. If we set up these type of agreements where people can access benefits across the world, this is something that's proactive.
So workers who are no longer in Canada can't get access to benefits that they paid into, but there are ways to change that, right? And are you aware of other countries where that's been done?
So Canada has an agreement with EI, with actually the United States. It was started, I believe, in 1942, and it's called an interstate agreement. And what the model is that people, for instance, who live in Canada but daily commuting work. So say, for instance, they live in Windsor once again, or Chatham, Ontario, or in Vancouver, and they travel to work in, say, Seattle or Detroit. Their benefits are very much, they're combined, right? So that they may pay into the American system, but when they're unemployed, they can actually access the Canadian system. Our pension system, once again, where our pensions are merged, Canadian pensions are merged with countries of Trinidad or Jamaica. So these are examples that we should be basing where we need to go. This is what we should be basing our bilateral agreements are, where rights are portable and we're improving the conditions for all people.
I was wondering if you could speak on if there has been any pushback against the campaign going forward right now, either from the agricultural industry, from government, even from some labor unions in certain sectors.
I think it's important for the listeners to understand. I guess this is where all of our political literacy is important in these type of discussions. So what I mean is that what the employer groups are saying is that they're mimicking some of the language that the community activist groups and radical groups are using. So when we call for status upon arrival, they don't disagree with the idea that migrant workers should have access to permanent residency. The difference is, So when you're listening to the discourse, it sounds very, very similar. But the difference is that, one, they want to, and this is the different employer organizations, the farm associations, the business federation, what they want is greater control and greater influence over our immigration system. So for them, it's about how much they can influence not only the growth of capital, but how our immigration rules. So it dictates about how it benefits them, rather than building our society or building our communities. And this is a concern that if the Manufacturers Association or the different mushroom organizations, for instance, have greater influence to develop and direct our immigration laws, it means it creates a more complicit labor force, which will accept pretty bad conditions if the end result is status upon arrival, status in Canada. So very much, I think, the employer organizations are trying to mimic, but they want the outcome of influencing immigration policies. The labor movement is a mixed, it's heterogeneous. It's not homogeneous at the moment in time. Some organizations have reacted, I think, with hostility towards some of our demands. Others have been, you know, bang on. So last week, the Unifor president, Gary Diaz, had actually retweeted support for our demand, which I look at as something extremely important. Members of the Public Service Alliance, the Canadian Union of Public Employees, the Office of the Ontario Provincial Service Employees Union, many rank and file members have undertaken support, and they're providing support in different parts of our campaign. So I think it's going to be a longer debate. I think there's many progressive elements who do support this, but we need a shift in culture in thinking in how we think of migrant workers, not as a threat to our jobs, but members of our community. Yeah, it's about building standards for all instead of thinking of migrant workers as a threat to our society.
One final point. How can people support this campaign, Harvesting Freedom?
Great question. So our website is harvestingfreedom.org. So hopefully you have a link to that, and our hashtag is also Harvesting Freedom. There's going to be events happening in Ontario, but happening also across Canada. So if people are interested in organizing a movie night, a roundtable discussion, tweeting, emailing, phoning your local member of parliament or the prime minister, these are some of the ways to get involved. But the first thing would be to check our website out, sign the petition, the change.org petition calling for status, and connecting with us further so we can develop a larger movement across Canada and across the world.
Well, thank you, Ricky and Chris, for being on the show.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yes, yes, and we will be in touch again. All right, so, Cody, we got to...
Maybe we'll go with some K-Non.
All right.
ABCs.
Here we go. I think we might go out on this. But while this is connecting up here, just to let you all know, you can check out fromthemargins.h-a-z.org, and you will find info there about this past show, the one going on right now, as well as other info on future episodes. Do check it out in the Facebook page, From the Margins. Take a look for it. You'll find it.
And Twitter, at From the Margins CHSR.
Yeah. Come. Sounds real familiar, doesn't it? Let's go. Play up.
Bundle up, my whole style is so cold. I glow like old guys who go bold. My flow got no front and a vocal. Your flow got no button, it's so old. I don't mean to sound like a showboat, but it's true, my persona's no joke. I've stepped into some kind of portal. I'm legend and sometimes I'm lobo. I'm from the most risky zone.
Extra crushed up linen, fly like Cessna. This type grew, I gave it birth. Now it's time again to give it a verse. Jamaican born, not a fan of the ganja. Clear vibe, Brooklyn to Somalia. Hear them goes in the background. Player, that is my sound. The green doesn't symbolize I made it on the top. Pioneer legend, and they call me Mr. Rock. No B word or N word, I don't need those words. Respect for hers. The game dried up, so we coming to Greece. Leading you right and treating you right to peace.
Gangsta, if it is.
essential. Fight with guns or utensils. So poor, nothing's confidential. Breakfast was not continental. And lunch could not complement all.